This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 88. Today, we're going to talk to Vishwas Lele, an Azure MVP, about application lifecycle management for developers in Azure. Recorded live July 22nd, 2015.
Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Windows Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, Exchange, Link, and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
And we're just two dudes telling you how we see it.
Hey, CJ, how's it going?
No.
There you go. What you been up to, bud?
Oh, it's been a busy few weeks, actually. I was at the Worldwide Partner Conference last week. It's a Microsoft conference. It was in, how do I say this without being rude?
Orlando.
Oh, actually, you know, I joke, but man, oh man, it was a sweaty mess down there. My God.
Welcome to my part of the world.
Yeah, it was toasty. So, yeah, I was down there last week, had a great time meeting with a bunch of Microsoft partners, ISVs building software for Office 365 and talking shop all week. And it was back-to-back meetings basically the whole week. Oh, and I got to go and see Atlantis. Golf clap for you, sir, as the .NET Rocks guys would say.
It's quite awesome, isn't it?
It is. I'm speechless, honestly. Like, it is totally spectacular. And the last time I saw that shuttle was on its last mission. And on the last mission for the shuttle program, STS-135. And so I saw it on the, you know, on the stack going up into orbit. And then so I thought, I got to go back and see Atlantis in her final resting place. Well, for at least for now anyway, at Kennedy Space Center. And it was mind-boggling, like just so cool. Really nicely set up and everything.
So without giving anything away, because this is definitely one thing you don't want to spoil for people who haven't seen it, but
yeah,
how did you like the way you first saw it? They did a good job, didn't they?
Amazing. Yeah. I think the whole, like the whole exhibit is totally totally spectacular. Like the way it's mounted, the way the whole entrance to the exhibit works, everything was really nicely done.
Yeah. All the quotes and everything and how you can get up close. And I was touched by it too.
I went along quite late at night. So it was after the end of one of the days of WPC. I drove out there and it was open till 7 p.m. So I took off and drove out there at about 5. And there were no lines. There were very few people around. And it was me at Atlantis had a bit of a moment, you know. It was kind of nice. Not to get too sentimental, but, you know.
No. Hey, speaking of, that's cool, man. I know I was on vacation last week and unlike you, I didn't do anything last week but sit on the beach.
I'm just sending you photos of like space porn.
Yeah. And I was trying, it took me forever to get them because the Wi-Fi at the house that we were at sucked. And we didn't have 4G. We didn't have 3G. We were the OG. We were the original Gs of cell phone.
How did you survive?
It was actually very nice. But when we needed it to figure out what the weather was like, if the storm was actually going to hit us, it's kind of a pain in the ass. But it was also a pain in the ass because I wanted to see some of the news about the Pluto flyby by New Horizons because that was, I'm sorry, I'm a bit of a geek on this one with space side, but that was pretty freaking awesome what they did.
Yep. Amazing. Yeah. We saw a bunch of that happen that week. It was nice.
It is very cool. And they, I will say all the articles and stuff, everything's all written for like the mass audience to go take a look at. And so they don't really go into a lot of the detail that I wanted to see about the program. I found it hard to find some of that info, but while I was surfing around on one of my slow connections last week, I did pick up that there was a Discovery Channel 1 hour documentary on New Horizons. It's called Mission Pluto. So if you look up for National Geographic, something called New Horizons, it's playing right now on like the Discovery Channel and stuff. I recorded and I watched it last night, and it doesn't show much about it once it gets there. It looks like it was very quickly produced, but it was unbelievable. Like, for example, I didn't realize that this spacecraft was – usually it takes 10 years for these things to build. They only had 4 years – from the time the program was greenlit, they only had 4 years to build the spacecraft and launch it, and they had 1 3-week window to launch it because of when – of Pluto's orbit on when they could actually reach it. Like from the time that it takes Pluto, I think something like 250 some odd years to orbit the sun.
Yeah, gotcha.
And it's only gone, like we've only been able to track his track Pluto's orbit for the last, I think 30-ish years or 40-ish years reliably. So they didn't really know. They had a hard time figuring exactly where the orbit was, but they knew the closest point that it would be to us was going to be like right now. And so they had to fire it at a certain time. So they had, first of all, the whole race thing to actually get it up and running. And by the time they launched it, they still didn't have some of the software done or really know exactly where it was going to be. And they just like, fire in that direction. We'll maneuver it as it's going out there. But there's a couple tiny little stats I found to be fascinating. So one, this thing flew, New Horizons was flying 9 miles per second, which comes out to 32,700 miles per hour, which comes out to 770,000 miles per day.
Jeez.
So it's kind of going a little quick.
That's kind of fast. Yeah.
The second, if it touched anything, like even something that was 10% the size of a dime, it would have torn right through it. And the spacecraft was so small that there was not a place on it that it could have been hit, that it would have been okay.
Wow.
What they did is that as they got closer and they started taking pictures of it, because the best pictures we had of Pluto were like these pixelated things that even Hubble was even getting good pictures of.
Yeah.
As they got closer and they started taking pictures a couple back in April of this year, so what was that, three months ago, they could see that there were four different moons that were orbiting Pluto and they were different sizes. And the better the pictures started coming into focus, they started to realize that it looked like something had contacted Pluto and had bounced off, and it was like fragments had popped off. And so that was the moon. And they're like, well, if that happened and it was going that fast, then there's a lot of debris and we're trying to fly within 6,000 or 8,000 miles of Pluto to take pictures. Yeah. We're flying
through a debris field.
Yeah, exactly. And so they had this interesting thing where the spacecraft only was powered by only 200 watts of power. So that's like 3.5 light bulbs that we're used to using like in our house.
Wow.
It couldn't operate every sensor at the same time. And it couldn't communicate while it was operating these sensors or maneuver. And it would take, when they would send it instructions on how to maneuver, it would take the spacecraft 4 days just to process the instructions that were sent to it before it could actually act on it. And so they're like, you know, we need to have a way to protect this thing. And so what they did is they told the spacecraft to turn around. So the dish that they were using to communicate back with Earth, they said, when you get close to Pluto, you're going to do a complete about face and you're going to fly into this theoretical debris field with the dish forward, because the dish is essentially the entire size of the spacecraft. So we'll use it as a protective kind of like plate. The spacecraft will then take all of its measurements and all that stuff for, it was only flying by for a span of 2 hours, 9 years flying 3 billion miles.
2 hours work, wow.
Some guys were dedicating like 26 years.
So that's all going right, wow.
And they only had a 2-hour window, take all these pictures. And then once it was past Pluto, then the thing would turn back around and start beaming back stuff and say, hey, we got things.
Gosh, that's a lot to put on the line, isn't it?
Yeah, I learned all that last night watching this Mission Pluto series. I highly recommend it for any space geeks out there. I thought it was really cool.
Major geek out.
Yeah, the guy that narrated it was a little too geeky for me, a little too dramatic, but it was interesting.
Yeah, cool. I'll definitely check that out. Hey, speaking of this, just before we head off with the topic for the day, you know, as we're nerding out about space here, literally there is a Soyuz being crewed up ready to go to ISS. I'm watching the tweet stream and the crew are getting in the capsule. So
I'm doing the exact same thing.
The internet's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I love this internet thing. It's pretty cool. Yeah. I'm gonna put some money into this. Hey, so we don't want to go on too much for the banter here for too long here, because we actually had a really good interview with a gentleman, an Azure MVP by the name of Vishwas Lele. So I don't know if anybody's familiar with his work. He is a very respected engineer and CTO for a company called AIS up in the Washington, D.C. area. He's got a couple courses on Pluralsight around Azure. And we talked today about a topic that I think is really popular, that's to me is near and dear to my heart is around application lifecycle management, or ALM, with Azure. And we talked for quite a bit, and we actually only got through about 60% of the stuff that I really wanted to talk about. And I know that he wanted to talk about as well. So we've already agreed that we're going to find another time to get together, because there are, we talked about cloud services, we talked about deployment slots, we talked about Project Kudu, we talked about GitHub, we talked about web apps, we talked about release management, we talked about resource management. It was a phenomenal discussion. The parts that I think that we want to dive into next time when we get together are going to be things around the area around really more like proactive maintenance and monitoring. So application insights, load testing, using machine learning to look at some of the diagnostic information to figure out what things can be dismissed, what things can be proactively acted on, stuff like that.
Nice. Yeah, this is it's kind of going to be a long show, but yeah. Stick with it.
Yeah, absolutely going to be a long show. I think it in part because I just went a little, we went a little too long on our space geek out, but it's been a bit spacey. I've been a bit spacey the last week.
There you go.
Yeah, man. So why don't we go ahead and roll the show, and we'll come back and just do a quick little wrap up at the end.
Sounds good.
All right. Today, I am talking to Vishwas Lele. Vishwas, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Andrew. Thank you.
I'm really excited to have you on the show today. Before we dive into this, I wanted to talk to you today about ALM and Azure, Application Lifecycle Management in Azure. And so how developers can take advantage of Azure for the development lifecycle, and how they can kind of get a nice continuous deployment going. But before we dive into that, I guess for people who are listeners who may not be familiar with you, I mean, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and where people can find you and such?
Sure, Andrew. Thank you. So my name again is Vishwas Lele, and I work for a company called Applied Information Sciences, which is based in the DC area. And I've worked there for the last 21 years or so. Joined them as a Windows 3.1 developer and have been developing on the Microsoft stack ever since. I've spent about last 6 or 7 years focusing a lot on Azure. And I'm proud to say that I'm also an Azure MVP, which has been an awesome program in terms of getting information. And your listeners can reach me on my Twitter alias, which is V as in Victor, and my last name, V as in Victor, L-E-L-E.
Awesome. Fantastic. So been doing Azure for quite a while, it sounds like. That's true, huh?
That is true, Andrew, because, you know, I like to claim that I had this great vision that, you know, Azure was going to be big, but that would be wrong. Back in 2008 early 2008, I should say, I got dropped into a project which was related to, at that time, BizTalk services, if you've heard of that. And, you know, just got dropped into that project, worked on it. There were many challenges, as you can imagine, but really enjoyed that part and thought that was fascinating. And then, of course, a year later, Azure was announced, and then rest is history, I suppose.
What were you doing before you got dropped into BizTalk and stuff? Where was your background before this?
So, Andrew, my background has been, like I said, I've been a developer on the Microsoft platform. So the company that I worked for, my first 6 years or so were spent on, we had to build a product called UniAccess, which is sort of a mainframe modernization product. And my first task was to help write an ODBC driver for that mainframe. So I spent quite some time writing this ODBC driver along with my other teammates, but a lot of sort of C++ type coding, MFC coding. And around 2005 or 6, got very interested in SharePoint. And did, I've been doing SharePoint. I like to joke, our Azure business or cloud business is growing. So I like to joke with people that, the daytime job is SharePoint because it's still such an important part of what we do. But I still focus on SharePoint a lot and enjoy sort of the bridge between SharePoint, Office 365 and Azure. So before I was full-time on Azure, I think I was spending a lot of time on SharePoint. And then, things like, Andrew, I wrote apps like the Media Center app for SharePoint, which is one of the first apps on the SharePoint App Store, which basically, it's a very simple, it's a free app. In fact, all it does is, it is a SharePoint-hosted app, and you can go create an account in Azure Media Services, go download this app for free, connected to the Azure Media Services credentials. And now, by virtue of that connection, I download all of the metadata about your videos into a SharePoint digital asset library.
Ah.
So now you can go view the videos, you can preview them and things like that. So it is sort of the combination of the two technologies that interests me a lot, Andrew.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's funny because your background is not too far off from like what mine was, in focusing a lot on SharePoint. And then kind of I've been more kind of following as SharePoint and Microsoft's push has been more for really pushing the product to Office 365 and being more of a service. And the on-prem stuff just kind of picking up on the benefits that Microsoft learns from hosting it on its own. But at the same time, as SharePoint's gone to the cloud, I've spent a lot more of my development moving up into Azure. And I know that, you know, a lot of our listeners and a lot of people I've talked to, one of the big things that I find that developers, I don't know if the right word is to say they struggle with it, but it's so much more that they have questions around how do they do the same things that they're used to today, working in, say, a more traditional on-prem approach to working in the cloud. And specifically, I really wanted to talk to you about application lifecycle management. And so the idea behind, you know, today in an on-prem world, as a developer, as a member of a development team, either a team of one or a team of a handful of people, I want to build something on my machine. I want to roll it into, say, a development or a consolidated build environment or dev environment. I want to go through test. I want to go potentially through QA. And then I want to go also into roll it into production and have different environments in different states and stuff. And I know that, you know, that's what we do on-prem, but I see, you know, there's different pieces to that are ancillary to these different projects, like storage or to databases and other services. And we always kind of, you always hear these academic discussions about, it's so easy to understand how the ALM works when it's just your code base. But when you look at the things that your application has dependencies on, that's where things get complicated. And then to me, it gets even more complicated or more of a challenge when you look at something like Azure. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, what do you see people doing with this development lifecycle in Azure, and how they're achieving it, how they're actually taking care of these different things and moving between these different environments. And so I guess, you know, a couple of things I want to talk to you about is, you know, considerations for continuous integration. What about build deployment, monitoring, load testing, and all that stuff? So how does that sound?
Right. No, I think, Andrew, you have framed it up really well in terms of, you know, when we talk to people about, you know, well, start using these services in Azure. And, you know, my experience is that, you know, if you start with a good sound .NET developer, they're able to figure out the APIs and services. But then how do you translate that into your development? And most likely, not all your applications are in the cloud. You still have a mix of applications that are being deployed on-prem. How do you manage your environment so that, you know, you're not just completely creating something separate? So I think that discussion is important. And if you want me to launch directly into the response to that, or I can, or if you wanted to expand further, what has happened is when you have to look at this question in sort of two or three dimensions. One is when Azure development got started, we had cloud services, right? And I shudder to call it PaaS V1, but you know, now we have things like app websites or Azure App Service now, or even now, which was announced at the build called the Service Fabric, which is even more advanced. So first we have to think of this discussion in terms of the progression that Azure has had. You know, from pure IaaS approach, PaaS V1, Azure websites and web apps now, and Service Fabric. That's one.
Okay.
The other sort of dimension that you have to think about is, you know, as the services evolved, the ALM story has also evolved. So, you know, you can do a lot more things with the build today, for example. Services like App Insight have come along, which allow you to monitor your application. Services like load testing have come along. So that's the other part you have to consider. Not only have the services evolved, all of the underlying, you know, tools that you have, ALM tools, and you can even call them sort of the DevOps tools. Yeah, I know you didn't use the word DevOps, but, you know, it's all being bundled into that one term.
Right.
And the third sort of dimension to think about is when I first started developing Azure applications, I was, you know, my source code repository was TFS hosted on-prem, right? And so what did we do? We ended up, well, we will extend our post deployments. You know, we'll add a custom deployment task, you know, call the command line tools like CSPAC, generate the packages, and then go deploy it as part of automation ourselves. But all of these things have changed. And I think in our conversation, we should sort of break them down and talk, you know, sort of take people through how these tools have come along and what should be they thinking about as they move forward.
Yeah, that sounds good. I mean, I know that there was, I definitely would like to do that. And I think, you know, one of the things you started to mention, you mentioned a little bit between the difference between PaaS and IaaS. I know that I'm curious to hear what your take is on this too, before we kind of dive into this, but I have a perception that it seems that there's still a tremendous amount of developers that stick with the traditional mindset that I'm building an application that's going to run on a box. And so they're building applications to start with from the ground up. They're building them on an IaaS instance, on a virtual machine, where to me, in my opinion, the part where you really get the advantage of this cloud infrastructure is building on top of a PaaS infrastructure and not or a PaaS platform, and not so much as on top of an IaaS platform where you have to feed and water and take care of the different virtual machines that you may have. And instead, you're simply going almost from like a Chinese menu type thing of saying, I need these different services and I'm going to essentially orchestrate them together to build a final solution. My code's the thing that brings everything together.
That's a very important point. And Andrew, I was listening to the latest episode of Hansel Minutes just yesterday. And, you know, Scott was talking to someone about systems-based thinking. And what really struck me there was that, of course, the emphasis is on, you know, writing code and learning to code. And what this guest that Scott had was talking about was, you know, before we start writing code, if we take a moment to think what building blocks can we use and how can we leverage them, mm-hmm. I think it will go a long way in making our application development exercise more productive. Mm. So to the extent we can leverage these building blocks, and then to the extent we can, quote unquote, outsource the management of cache, the management of database, management of role-based security or authentication outside of our application, that certainly makes our application more productive, more robust, easier to manage, and all that. So I completely agree with your point that if you are building an application that even may not be targeted to the cloud right now, even if you're building a brand new application that you're being told that should run on an on-prem infrastructure, I encourage you to think about that application and make decisions that do not preclude it from running in the cloud later on.
Mm.
So that's an important thing to consider there as well.
That makes a lot of sense, I guess. And the recent announcement of what we used to know as the Azure pack, and then we had...
So now we are calling it Azure Stack.
That's it, the Azure Stack, yes. So love Microsoft, always changing names on us. Yes. Yeah, so that gives you the ability to still build... I guess in the past, before the Azure pack, the Azure Stack, if you wanted to build something that could run both on-prem and in the cloud, then you really were building... You were without a lot of extra work, you were really building for IaaS. But now with Azure pack or Azure Stack, that you have the ability to really take advantage of these PaaS-based offerings, either in the cloud or on-prem in your own private data center.
That is right. That's absolutely right. And in fact, we will talk about Resource Manager later on, Andrew. But what was most fascinating to me from the Azure Stack perspective is that, you know, I played with Azure Pack, and, you know, it was a great step forward in trying to make certain services that were available in the cloud make them available on-prem, but not all services were available, A. B, even though they tried to make the automation story consistent between the two environments, there was not 100% consistency between the two. So there was a service management API previously, a precursor to Resource Manager, and they tried to take the service management API, and similar, it was not parameter by parameter compatible, but the sense was that a similar API exists. But with the Azure Stack, the most interesting part to me is Azure Resource Manager, and think of that as your control plane for Azure going forward. Every new service that gets added will be controlled using Azure Resource Manager. And the fact that you can take that same JSON-based declarative model and apply it to your on-prem environment is going to be a huge plus. So imagine a scenario where I am building an application that deals with some classified data, or the application itself has some security classification, which precludes it from going on the public cloud. But you're probably fine with doing the dev test in the public cloud. So imagine that you go through a process where you're deploying this dev test application to the public cloud, but using the same scripts essentially to say, oh, when you go to staging or go to production, go to my on-prem environment. So I think having that consistent control plane between on-premises and the cloud is really important. Mm. And you know, we don't have access to the Azure stack yet, but there were a bunch of demos at the Build conference, and I think there was one at the Ignite conference as well. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting to me, and looking at some screenshots, the number of services that are available, both the parity of services between the cloud and on-prem was really very interesting, because something like Azure Stack can succeed only if you have all the tools that you love and enjoy in the cloud.
Yeah, I would agree. I would definitely agree with that. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about, jump into some of the ALM stuff here. So I guess first thing you want to talk a little bit about is like with cloud services and like some of the considerations we have between dev test and production deployments. And then what about manual deployments versus automated deployments? So what kind of things do you see people doing, or what kind of things do you recommend people take a look at when they're diving into this?
So yeah, let's start with cloud services, and you know, probably just help to just spend 30 seconds on this. So cloud services is the most widely used PaaS service today. It was the first service that was announced when Azure came along. And the idea of a PaaS service, for those who have not worked on it, is, you know, you essentially are getting a VM, but if you get a web role, you get IaaS installed. If you have a worker role, you essentially get a VM minus the IaaS. But for all intents and purposes, you own that VM. And the benefit, of course, over infrastructure as a service is that you are not dealing with, or you're not having to apply the hotfixes and patches. You can certainly RDP into that machine and look at things, but you don't have to be responsible for applying the hotfixes and things like that. But the other benefit is, and Andrew, you mentioned earlier, that you know, there may be some third-party components. There may be things that are just not Xcopy deployment friendly. So the one great benefit of a cloud service was that you can have a startup task there, which can run in an elevated mode, and you can go deploy certain things. You can deploy a third-party application, make a registry change if you have to, and things like that. Mm. So that's really the sense of cloud service, very widely used. I would say a lot of Microsoft's own services are using cloud services. Because you have your own VM, it takes a few minutes for you to get that environment up and running, and as it makes sense. So you go to Azure and you say, here's my code, here's my application package, here's my configuration file. And oh, by the way, here is how I would want you to configure. I want two web role instances. I want these firewall ports open and things like that. And Azure Fabric Controller, which is really the brain behind Azure, is taking all of this information and saying, okay, fine. I'm going to find this virtual machine. I'm going to make sure it has the right guest OS option, and then I'm going to deploy your application package. I'm going to boot up this machine. I'm going to add it to the load balancer. And now here's how your 5 or 6 minutes are spent. And oh, by the way, you know, if you have told me about your upgrade domains and fault domains, I'll make sure they get placed in the data center so there is no single point of failure, you know, which means I'll put you in a different, they'll not share the top of the rack switch and so on and so forth.
Right.
So that takes about 5 minutes to come online. And what I've seen in the past is, if you're a really small shop, you know, you are just building a simple service, you're a really small team, people have often just written a simple PowerShell script. They will do a build, and as they will tag along at the end of the build some kind of a CSPAC command. After the build is successful, they will use the CSPAC command to generate this application package, and then have a PowerShell script, you know, and by the way, take that CS package, the application package, upload it to Blob Storage, and then run a PowerShell command which will then automatically go call the service management API and create this cloud service for you. So, you know, small teams works quite well, and you can put in things in there saying, before you hit this deployment step, make sure you run the smoke test. And if the smoke test is successful, go ahead and then go deploy this cloud service. You know, this is how people have done this. Lately, this is a very recent development. And people who've been working with websites will know this because this is how websites work. But lately, what Microsoft has done is if you go to the Azure portal and say, I want to create a new cloud service, I can at that time connect it to VSO. Okay? So I can connect it to VSO. And then by virtue of that connection, I can now go do a check-in into VSO. A build will kick in, and then my package will be deployed in an automated manner in that case. So that's a very recent development. You don't have to code all of that yourself. You can take advantage. And this is, Andrew, goes back to what I was saying, that not only have these services gone up, the ALM story and the tooling that Microsoft has gone up as well. So to your listeners, if you are building a cloud service today, you can certainly go with the route that I mentioned and, you know, do that. But you can also now I encourage you to take advantage of the VSO integration that comes with cloud service. So that's cloud service. Now, one other thing you mentioned, Andrew, there was, you know, I may not have all of the ALM tools together in the cloud. I may be using VSO, but, you know, the work item management does not lend itself to all the customizations that I'm seeking. And, you know, my work item customization, I'm quite happy with my on-prem work item customization and things like that. So, you know, I want to use VSO, but I want to use work item customization that may be sitting elsewhere. Or, you know, I'm quite happy with, you know, a build system which is installed locally on my on-prem infrastructure. And can you do a mix and match of that? And that's certainly possible. Visual Studio Online support REST API. So you can go get that information from VSO, or it supports webhooks. You can tell VSO that, you know, build is completed. And I know you've talked about this, Andrew, in the past. You can use something like as simple as Zapier. Go into Zapier and say, you know, when VSO build is successful, please notify me. And by the way, take this next step and send this to let's say, a Jira, that and track that this build was completed. So you can do mix and match of those things there in that manner.
Awesome. Yeah. So, and for our listeners too, when you're saying VSO, we're talking Visual Studio Online, the hosted, kind of hosted source control. And there's even a web-based version of Visual Studio that Microsoft hosts as well. That's like their hosted TFS.
That's right.
And then on the Zapier piece that you're mentioning too, that's, I guess there's other companies that are similar to Zapier, things like IFTTT or If This Then That. And basically what it does is allows you to have different recipes that listen for events from some services and then do some very simplified workflows and have that system do something else on your behalf. So like, for instance, you could use it to say, when a build is done, send me an email, or when a build is done, go notify Azure to do this pull from the code base into this site or something like that.
That's exactly right.
Cool. That, I guess the big thing that we're seeing people doing more of these days is not so much the manual deployments of their code into, like, say, the codes in the cloud services or even in like the web apps or websites in Azure, but they're doing more of these automated deployments. Would you say that's a safe thing to say?
That is a safe thing to say. And you know, you can have different levels of maturity there. Having just a simple PowerShell script that I defined, which takes an uploaded app package and deploys it to the cloud, as you know, this could be 10 lines of PowerShell script versus a full-fledged, you know, I want to do a build, I want to run a smoke test. And if my smoke test is successful, if I've achieved my quality of build metrics that I've laid out, then go ahead and go deploy it. So all the way from there.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've seen that Microsoft has added, and they've built on this feature quite a bit over the last few months or 6 months or so, is the availability of deployment slots, both for like the cloud services and the websites. But to me, I mean, that piece is so huge. So like one of the things that I like to use these for, I guess for the listeners, what a deployment slot is let's say you have a website and you can have essentially think of a website, but having like version A, version B, version C, version D of that website. And you could have those different slots, those different areas you can deploy code. They can be different versions of your web application that you've deployed, but it's different code bases. And so like I like to use it personally as I have the main version of my web app, but then I have one or two deployment slots. One's used for like an unminified version of my web application. One's used for all my testing. And then one uses like this is like the pre-prod. This is where I would normally have things, what my site would look like if I had deployed it. And you can set up with these different deployment slots, you can set up automated deployment so that when they see a check-in or a push from Visual Studio Online or from GitHub, they can say, all right, now that we've seen that push on a specific branch, we'll automatically do a pull from that repository. We'll pull that in from these other projects, again, from Visual Studio or from Visual Studio Online. And maybe based on a setting that we have in the deployment slot, I'll just take a subfolder from your code base and deploy it into this deployment slot. And what that gives people the ability to do is, let me go test and make sure that everything looks good running up inside of Azure. I personally don't use the main application. I don't do automated deployments from there, because then once you have things running in your deployment slots, if everything looks good, you can just hit a little button that just says, let me just swap it around. So the production pointer, I'm using that in air quotes, the production pointer doesn't point to the original site. It now points to, like, say, deployment slot C, which is now my production instance. So you can really see things up and running and then just kind of flip the switch and say, oh yeah, now all of a sudden we're up in production. That's one of the biggest benefits I've seen that they've really done in the last few months.
That's right. And you know, the cloud services have a staging slot and a production slot, Andrew. And then in the Azure app service, specifically the web apps, you can have up to 5 slots. And I think what you described is a very interesting capability. And people find this funny. It's called testing in production. Mm-hmm. And it is supposed to be a good thing. And the idea is that if you go into the web app, there's this setting called request routing. And once you've created the slots, as you described, Andrew, you can say that this slot will get, let's say, 0.01% of that traffic. Okay. And what will happen is, as people come to your production site, that 0.01% of that traffic is sent to that testing and production slot, where you may have an alpha version of your software running. And you can now see what the behavior is, what the response time is. Did people, you know, let's say if you have some kind of a wizard or you're getting some kind of a sales code process or something like that, you can monitor that and see if people are liking that or not liking that. And the way it works under the covers is, there's a testing in production or TIP cookie that gets issued. So once you have that cookie, you're sent to that slot. And you, of course, can give the user the option. You can tell them that, hey, looks like you have been routed to our more advanced capability, which is still in testing. If you're comfortable using this is fine. If not, and you want to be redirected to the main production application, click here. And you can get rid of the cookie and then get them redirected back to one of the other slots where the original code is stored. So I think that's a huge capability.
When did that get added? I didn't even know that Azure was had that capability.
So yeah, this is pretty recent, and you can do it in the new Azure portal. Once you've created the slots, you can go to this feature was called testing in production, but I think it had a sort of negative connotation to it. So I think it is called request routing. You can go to request routing and you can say, please send 0.01% of my traffic to here. And you can certainly go from there.
Huh. That's pretty cool. I didn't know that they added that. It's a common practice that you do hear people doing to where, like, I know like Facebook's production system is similar to that, where when they roll out new features, it goes out to, like, say, 10 servers, and they have automated testing that watches the performance of both the servers and the code and seeing errors come back. And if that looks good over the course of some set time frame, then it rolls it out to 100 servers and then onto 1,000 and then 10,000, ultimately out to the 50,000 or 60,000 servers that they use to run Facebook. So And it's definitely not a new thing, but it's new to Azure. At least it's new to me. So,
and Andrew, if I may take a step back, so you asked me to talk about cloud services, and we said, why it takes some additional few minutes because you're getting your own VM, and then we talked about how people were doing automated deployments through scripts, and now you can sort of at the time of creation of a cloud service, you can connect it to a VSO, and take advantage of that capability. So I encourage your listeners to look at that. But let's take us just maybe a minute to talk about websites, or now called the web apps, because that is to me a PaaS V2. And by the way, these are on my terms that I'm using. So I think of cloud services as a great platform as a service offering. That is how Microsoft came out with. And then we transitioned into something called the websites or the web apps now. So I'll use the term web apps. And the beauty there is that you don't have the entire virtual machine. You basically are getting a virtual directory inside an existing VM. You can, of course, scale it out and say you want to run inside your own dedicated machine. You can certainly do that. But by virtue of the fact that you are not having to wait for this entire machine to get deployed and joined to the load balancer, the deployments are far quicker. And since it came after cloud services, they had more time to think about it. So from the very beginning, you have had this capability. When you create a web app, you can say, please connect it to a source code repository. And it could be Git, it could be VSO, it could be any number of options there. Mm-hmm. So if we sort of take the same question that you asked earlier, which is how are people doing automated deployments and things like that? Well, Azure websites and now web apps has had a very strong story there. And we talked about VSO in the previous part of the discussion. Let's talk about GitHub. So I go create a new website or a web app, and I can say, please connect it to my GitHub account. And by virtue of now me checking code into that GitHub account, a build will get triggered, and then it will automatically deploy those binaries to my slot within that Azure web app.
Mm.
So that was big and very important to note that the enabling technology is something called, one of my favorite things about Azure websites, called the Project Kudu, which is, and this is a little trick for the listeners. Let's say your website is called abc.azurewebsites.net. If you add a prefix there, called SCCM in there, so abc.sccm.azurewebsites.net, you're taken to that Kudu portal. And if you go into that Kudu portal, it's really amazing that even though you're running in a PaaS service and you don't have full control of the VM, you have a console that you can run, you can inspect the files, you can look at the logs. And that Kudu is really powering that synchronization. If a file change happens in GitHub, it is detecting that and then making that change and deploying that to the Azure website. So that's all that works quite well. And that's what most people are doing today, using either PowerShell scripts or just using Azure Resource Manager for that.
Yeah, that Kudu is really, really powerful in the sense that, I love the fact that we've got console tools, both on Windows or on Linux or on OS X, that I can essentially take my console and shift it to where now my local console on my laptop is really now my console, like I'm running on the same box as where my web application is. And so that now I can even do like a DIR and I can see a list of all the files in the root directory of my application, or I can see the logs. I run a multi-tenant instance of the Orchard CMS open source engine. And there's a section in there where there's a settings folder that has some information about all the different tenants that I'm using on my different websites. So one of the settings is what's the theme. Another one is what's the Azure blob of where all the files are and what's the database connection. Mm-hmm. And that's the one piece of my web application that I don't ever want to lose. It's checked into source control, but I don't mind if the rest of my application gets blown away because it's just code. So it always can get redeployed, but it's nice that, when I go back in and I see another push go from GitHub over to my web application, it's nice to use Kudu to be able to connect in and say, let me go look at the settings and see, why isn't this site working? It's like, oh, well, one of the settings files is a little messed up, but I can see that the same way I normally would do it, say 10 years ago, by FTPing into my shared host.
That's right. And in fact, since you're talking about Kudu, there's a very interesting concept there called extensions, which you may be using, Andrew, where you can, you know, the rightmost tab in the project Kudu console is extensions. You could click on extensions and say, show me all the extensions that are available. And because the standard interface, Microsoft has written a few, and, you know, other developers have written extensions, and you can go and right click and say, install that extension into my Azure web app. And by virtue of that installation, you get some additional capabilities. And one of my favorite extensions there is something called Diagnostic as a Service. Hmm. So what you can do is you can go into Azure web apps and say, turn on logging, turn on IaaS logging, or turn on any kind of logging. And all of that data gets stored, you know, and you can provide a storage information. All the data is getting stored into Azure blob storage. And you can then take that Azure Diagnostic as a Service extension and say, and let's say you're getting a memory leak or you're getting exceptions in your, you can go to that, once you've installed that extension, Diagnostic as a Service, you can say, go analyze the logs and come back with some plausible reasons for why I'm getting this. And, you know, it'll come back and, you know, and say, you've been getting these exceptions related to this. And, you know, it's just an analysis of the log with some analysis of, with some, you know, help in sort of giving you what could be the reasons behind the exceptions you're seeing or the slowness in the website.
Oh, so it's a little bit of like a, I guess a little bit of like machine intelligence or machine learning on what's going on, what problems you may be having with your app and how you could, some things, some common solutions you could take to address them.
That's right.
That's pretty cool. So let me ask you about two other things here that I'll admit I'm very green to these two things. So one is around the Azure Resource Manager and one is around like the release management stuff that we have inside of Visual Studio and in Azure. So can you talk a little bit about what these are, how people can take advantage of these?
Absolutely. So let's talk about Azure Resource Manager first. So up until now, and I've used the term Service Management API a couple of times. So that was sort of the first automation story when Azure came out, right? You know, you create a cloud service, you delete a cloud service, you upgrade a cloud service, you create a storage account, and on and on and on. Azure Resource Manager was first announced at Build 2014. And the idea is that you have this ability to logically organize your resources within Azure. So there's a concept of a resource group. You can put your resources within the resource group. And if you look at the Azure portal today, I'm not talking about the preview portal, but the existing portal, let's say you click on the VM tab, you see all the VMs there. Or if you click the storage tab, you see all your storage credentials. What is really missing there is there's no way to sort of logically organize and say, you know, these two VMs and these two cloud services belong to this application. Right? Mm-hmm. Everything is sort of presented to you. So the idea of Resource Manager is, it is sort of the, going forward, it is the control plane for Azure, which means all automation should be done using Resource Manager. And the benefit is that it provides you an imperative model. So you can say, create an Azure website, go deploy the bits, so you can imperatively tell it, or you can declaratively through a JSON file, define what you want. And take that JSON file, give it to the Azure Resource Manager, and it will go ahead and provision those things. So If you, you know, as we see new resources coming along, DocumentDB, web apps, app service, logic apps, all of those are being provided through the Azure Resource Manager. So think of you can create a resource group, you can start putting your resources within the resource group. And one other important benefit to note here is that previously in the old portal, you can either be admin or a co-admin. And if you're a co-admin, you have access to all the services. The new portal allows you the role-based access control model, and you can now apply RBAC style permissions on top of a resource or a resource group.
Mm.
Okay. So yeah, I know I've sort of, you know, said a lot of things about Azure Resource Manager in the short period of time. So, to take a step back, Going forward, if you're doing automation, you should definitely look at Resource Manager. And my suggestion is look at the declarative model first. And for your listeners, an important tip is David Ebo wrote a very interesting tool called the Azure Resource Explorer. And I, you know, you can just find it, Google for it. And you can now start playing with the Azure Resource Manager very quickly. So if you're trying to automate, use a declarative model. If you are trying to, the other benefit of the declarative model is that it is also idempotent. So you can reapply those JSON templates again and again without having to worry about causing some ill effect. Only the changes will get applied. So that's an important story going forward from an automation standpoint. So, and I'll come back to this in a moment. Let me just introduce the release management, the other thing you talked about. So as I said earlier, the ALM tools have been growing in conjunction with other services in Azure. So people are familiar with the release management, which is a product which you can install on-prem. And the idea there is that what if you have a somewhat sophisticated workflow that takes you from development to test to staging to production, right? You have this workflow where you have the development lead doing an integrated build, pushing the bits to test, and then you have a QA lead going and running the tests and saying, yes, I approve this, and that moving on to a staging environment, and maybe you want to run a load test, and maybe the load test manager goes and approves. If you wanted to sort of automate that workflow, release management is the tool for that. So it gives you that sophistication that, you know, people often do through email and phone calls. Am I ready to go deploy to staging? Yes, fine. And, you know, all that process can be automated. So up until now, when we talk about release management 2013, you had to install it locally on your on-prem environment. And what Microsoft announced recently is, much like you explained VSO, there's an online version of release management where you can, without having to, and it is powered by the workflow, Windows Workflow Foundation, the same workflow technology, so you can define your workflows. And so you have an online version of the release management, so you can take advantage of that. The way you should think about release management and Resource Manager together is, think of Resource Manager as the way to provision and deploy, and think of release management as the workflow that you may go through to deploy your application, go through the various gates and stages.
Okay, that makes sense. That helps. That definitely helps. Huh, it's powerful stuff that they're giving us now, for giving developers now, to be able to really have a really good story for deploying stuff. And it actually, I think it really does. They give us more tools and there's more options for us. But I think that one of the things it really does for us as well is it really does simplify things, because there's less stuff for us to, as developers, less stuff for me to break when they're managing everything inside of Azure for me. And I'm just giving them instructions on and orchestrating how I want things to flow through these different environments or using these different tools.
That's right. And Andrew, an important thing which I neglected to mention earlier is, you know, we've been writing scripts for a long time, and, you know, people have been writing PowerShell scripts for a long time. And one thing I find often is, you know, in order to be successful in the cloud, you need to have a robust automation story. And people who have written PowerShell scripts in the past, you know, they have not applied sort of the same, you know, as developers, we will check our code into source control. We worry about exception handling. We worry about reuse. We worry about writing unit tests and things like that. The same rigor has not been applied to when it comes to writing PowerShell scripts or scripting in general. And you can only be confident about your automation story only if you think that your scripts are as robust as any other piece of code you write. And what we are seeing is, you know, a lot of script sprawl, if you will, that, you know, people are writing all kinds of scripts. And, you know, are you comfortable in just sending the script over to someone and, you know, be sure that it will work just as it works for you? What the Resource Manager model does is, because it is declarative and I can define in a JSON, I can say, I want these resources. I want a website. I want a document DB. I want an Azure SQL database. and here are my properties, and I want it to be this size, and I define all that in a JSON template, I'm also reducing the imperative code that I have to write, which can then be, problematic and, may lead to errors and things like that. The other benefit from their perspective is if you give them a declarative model, they can figure out that, these two tasks are independent and can be parallelized.
Mm.
So you can say, I want these many instances of this, but I want 20 instances of something. And they're not really dependent on each other. In fact, there is a tag inside the ARM called depends on. So if they can figure out the dependencies and they're not dependent, they can certainly parallelize. And you'll hear things which were discussed at Build this year, things like VM set. So let's say I want 100 VMs. And we do this for a customer of ours who needs a large number of machines together. And the concept of VM sets, I want 100 machines, and you can get back 100 machines without having to serially wait for those machines to be spawned. So that's the other important benefit there.
Ah, that's very cool. I wasn't aware that they actually did that. That's pretty cool. So I know we're coming a bit to the end of our talk here. I know we've gone for a good bit here, and I think we're just touching the surface. There's a bunch of other things like monitoring and load testing around, like talking about Azure App Insights or load testing. So maybe we can find a time that we can kind of link up again, and we can kind of continue this discussion to go into a little more depth on maybe the monitoring. We've talked a lot about how do we deploy and manage stuff, but then how do we actually get analytics on what we've deployed and make sure that what's running up in the cloud, everything is running in a good state. So maybe we can find another time we can get together and do that.
Absolutely. I think we haven't talked about three important things. One is, the App Insight, as you said, Andrew, that, I want to monitor the health of my application. I want to take advantage of just-in-time instrumentation. Right? I have logging in place, but there are certain aspects which I don't have logging to take advantage of. I want to have somebody monitoring the availability of my application across different points in the country. And I want to be alerted if a certain condition is met. So we should talk about that. And then load testing, I think, out of all of these tools, I think load testing is so important. It certainly makes it easier to perform load tests that you don't have to wait till the end to run a load test. And the last thing we should talk about after load testing is something called the machine learning part, which is, now your application is running, you're getting alerts, and you can react to those alerts. But wouldn't it be better if you sort of have some machine learning algorithms look at what is going wrong and sort of do some, trigger you on some predictive maintenance that you can take advantage of, and which is what the Azure SQL database team is doing today, that, they run these machine learning algorithms, which tell them that, this server is looking a bit different or behaving strangely, and maybe we need to go and take the server out of rotation and then add another server. So the final leg sort of is the predictive analytics part.
Yeah.
So I think it'll be good to talk about those three things at a later time.
Yeah, we should definitely find another time, because we're just scratching the surface on it. Those three things, those are definitely huge in helping developers build more stable, more robust, and more performant applications, getting more insights in what things are going on, and being more proactive in maintaining and optimizing their applications, and being much less reactive. Well, hey, I really appreciate you taking the time and talking to me today. Again, if you would just share with us your Twitter, your blog address, where people can find you, and definitely tell me a little bit about some of the courses I've seen. I see that you have on Pluralsight. I see you released another one just recently.
Thank you, Andrew, for asking about those. I have a couple of courses already. There was a course that I released last year called Applied Azure, where I took a in my journey of working with Azure projects for the last 7 or 8 years, I've seen those kinds of application patterns repeated. So it's a 5 or 6 hour course. I take 10 different patterns and talk about those. That was the course last year. But I'm most excited about the course that released last week, which is called Cloud-Oriented Programming. And really the motivation behind that, Andrew, was that, we talk about the tenets of the cloud. We talk about, how it is high scale, it is utility billing-based model, and, we talk about PaaS services, and we talk about cloud-native applications. Those are all fine and great, But what can I do as a developer? How does cloud impact my life as a developer? And what can I do at a code level that aligns my code in line with all the benefits of the cloud that has to offer? So in that course that I just released last week, I have 9 such tips that, you know, if you're writing exception handling code, maybe you should do it this way. If you're organizing your code, maybe take advantage of things like containers and microservices. You should be worrying about cost. It is not just the project manager's or architect's responsibility to be worrying about how much this application is going to cost. You can do things at the code level to make sure that you're using the cloud-based resources effectively. So I talk about those developer code level things to sort of improve your effectiveness of the cloud.
It looks really interesting. I've pulled down, I have to clear out some other modules of other courses that I pulled down for offline viewing so that I can get all of your modules on here. I've got 2 of them that are already on here. I'm looking forward to going through this course myself, but you got a lot of good stuff in here, it looks like. It's a lot. It was a good solid 3 hours or so of content here. It goes through a lot of stuff. So definitely looking forward to taking a look at that one.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Your feedback was greatly appreciated.
Awesome. So yeah, so the people can find you on Twitter at VLELE.
Yes, please.
And then also same thing for your blog. It's VLELE.wordpress.com. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks a lot for the time today. I really do appreciate it. I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of this.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right, cool. CJ, that was my discussion with Vishwas. So what'd you think? Good show?
Oh, Vishwas is awesome. I listened to his show on the .NET Rocks show the other week as well. So if people want even more of Vishwas, then they can go find him on the .NET Rocks show as well for another one. Or also he's on Twitter at VLELE.
Yep. I've got links to his blog, to Twitter. We got those up on the show notes. And I also have links to his Pluralsight courses, which he released one, like he said in the podcast, he released one last week, or I guess by the time our show releases, it'll be about 2 weeks ago. But it's, man, it's really good. I've spot listened to a few pieces of it. I got to go delete some modules on my iPad so I can pull this one offline and watch this for a big flight that I got coming up. So
yeah, I got to go check that out. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, he did a good job with it. So
hey, nice interview.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So we got some more stuff lined up coming in the future. But hey, before we cut this loose, we are quickly coming up on episode 100. And we got a few things that we're going to do for episode 100. But if anybody, it's not going to be a real content show. We're going to have some fun. Hey, anybody wants to record something and send it in to, you know, for us to play on the show to have some fun?
Send us your messages. If there's particular things you like about the show or just want to say hi, record them as a wave file, right?
Yep.
Record them as a wave and then send them to us. And you might get played on the show. We'd love to have you guys included as part of episode 100.
What was your favorite show? What was your least favorite show?
Favorite show, least favorite show, funniest moment, something, some funny commentary or something you want to bring up with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything like that would be kind of funny or whatever. I mean, we'd love to play it. And go to the website. We've got a contact form. Go there. There's a place where you can just drop a little message in and just put a public link to a Dropbox or a Google Drive or a OneDrive or whatever place where I can download the WAV file. We'll make sure we get it. We'll take a listen to it and hopefully we can get it in. And hey, just keep it kind of clean. Okay, guys?
Yeah, please.
Cool. All right, CJ, let's wrap this guy.
Thanks, mate.
If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3 file and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Eric by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find a full transcript and show notes of each episode. You can find us on Facebook searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.